This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A year ago today, the Supreme Court issued two rulings on affirmative action in higher education. The admission system used by the University of Michigan's law school was upheld. The point system for undergraduates at Michigan was struck down. But the court ruled that diversity is important enough to justify otherwise unfair admissions policies. Race can still be a factor. Affirmative action proponents declared victory and said diversity on college campus had been saved. Now, a year later, the University of Michigan says applications from minority students are down about 21%. Considering that overall applications are down almost 18%, the university said the drop in minority numbers is just a small dip. Others look at those numbers and wonder what's going on. Later in the program, an interview with Francis Huynh, the author of a new book called Idiot Proof, about the counter-enlightenment. But first, diversity in higher education. We'll talk about what's happening at the University of Michigan and at other schools around the country, including the University of Texas in Austin, which doesn't use affirmative action, but still faces questions about fairness in admissions. If you're a student or a faculty member, what's your school doing about diversity and what's the best way to achieve it? Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now to give us an update on the situation at the University of Michigan a year later is Jeremy Berkowitz, a news editor at Michigan Daily. It's an independent student newspaper at the University of Michigan. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you very much.
Remind us, the Supreme Court decision eliminated that controversial point system for undergraduates. Only 2 months later, the school unveiled a new admissions process. What's in that?
Well, the entire application was revamped, pretty much. They got rid of the point system, and what they did is they tried to add more writing components. Previously, there had been one essay for students to write. Now what they did is they added a few more. They added two 250-word essays along with one long 500-word essay, all of which were required for the application. They tried to do what the university called a holistic review, trying to still gain diversity, but trying to find out through student experiences about diversity by asking them, what have you overcome in life? Do you come from a disadvantaged background? What's your favorite book? An experience in your life, which has had a major impact on you. They also added several new optional questions about what type of education your parents had, what sort of financial situation they were in. They also changed how they looked at the applications. You know, it used to be that a reader would look at an application and they would be taking, you know, they would use the point system. Okay, this SAT grade gets this many points, had this GPA gets this many points. Now what they did, they'd add up in the end, that wouldn't be the final decision, but I mean, the point system, you know, played a large role in determining
who got in, who didn't. Right. Now, the primary component, as I'm hearing it from your description, that accounts for affirmative action part, for giving a leg up for minorities, is those essays.
Exactly.
Okay. A year later, the school has said the minority applications are down 21%. Nevertheless, administrators are quite optimistic. How does that compute?
Well, they claim that the administration claims that applications are down all over the place, mainly because the economy hasn't been the greatest this year. They do admit that, with all the media attention that the university received, not just this year, but over the past 6 years, African-American students, Hispanic students may have been a little discouraged to apply to the university. They also say that the application system isn't perfect. It's in its first year. They plan to look, once the final results come in October and even the summer, looking at with the preliminary data, they plan to, try and retool and hopefully improve for next year.
Some say that the dip in applications is due to those essays that we were talking about. These take a lot more time.
Right. I remember talking with high school students in December, just as letters were starting to come back from the university, accepting, rejecting, or putting students on a wait list. There were some students, especially in the state of Michigan, who were discouraged by this. You have to remember many students, Michigan has a very good public university system, 15 public universities. The state takes a lot of pride in them. You'll have many students who will in Michigan who will only apply to the University of Michigan and Michigan State University. And previous to this year, you know, University of Michigan, you know, its application was a lot easier than it is now. So you have a lot of students from different areas who, you know, were complaining a little bit that, you know, that they did have to fill out a longer application than, let's say, maybe their older siblings or older friends had to. They were also a little concerned about essays, about some of the essays, especially, you know, one of the primary concerns that students at the University of Michigan had when the application was revealed at the end of August was that high school students would not be able to grasp what diversity was. Mm-hmm. What diversity was. That, you know, many high school students, whether they came from an affluent area or from an inner city, they did come from segregated areas. They didn't understand what the importance of diversity was. And many of the college students, many of the leaders in student government acknowledged themselves that they really did not grasp the true definition of diversity until they came to school.
So a year later, how are students reacting? I'm sure there was, this whole case focused on the University of Michigan, two different parts of it. Is diversity still a big issue on campus?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As you know, Ward Connerly, who's a University of California regent, came to Michigan in July and tried to is trying now for 2006. Not so much. They've given up on 2004. They weren't able to get enough signatures to get what was similar to Proposition 209 in California. In other words, having the voters decide whether they want the state universities to use race as a factor in admissions. So obviously, student groups on campus are trying to fight this. You know, obviously, they have another 2 years ahead of them. I mean, I'm sure that, although who knows how much Connerly's campaign was deterred by this recent defeat. I mean, the state, there was an appeal to the petitions that one of the Court of Appeals eventually decided to, it said the petitions were fine, but it's a little too late now for them to get signatures for the ballot.
And any student groups on Connerly's side?
On Connerly's, yeah. There is the Young Americans for Freedom. There are some of the local, Republican Party groups, even though the state Republican Party isn't officially endorsing the proposition. There are several conservatives on campus who are for such a proposition.
Okay, Jeremy, thanks very much. Jeremy Berkowitz, news editor at the Michigan Daily, an independent student newspaper at the University of Michigan, and he was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Well, with us also here in Studio 3A is Scott Jasik, editor of Higher Ed Today, a publication that will debut later this year, and it looks more closely at how colleges and universities are striving for diversity, at least in one of his articles that he's written before this new publication begins. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Many after the decision a year ago today in the Supreme Court declared many of those in favor of affirmative action declared victory. Your piece suggests maybe that declaration was premature.
Or at least it was a partial victory. It's important to note that the Supreme Court made two rulings. And in the ruling that threw out the undergraduate system, they basically said you couldn't use point systems, you couldn't use things that applied just to minority groups. And an awful lot of colleges had systems of admissions that were basically declared unconstitutional. Generally, these were larger colleges, and so they do have to revamp things. The reason Michigan wants those essays is that they still want to use GPA in college preparatory courses and standardized tests, and on those tests, certain groups, on average, do better than others. So they need something to preserve the diversity.
And the essays themselves, as Jeremy was saying, and the numbers indicate, may be somewhat problematical.
Well, whenever a college changes its admission system, you'll have a sort of delayed reaction. People don't understand it. The essays, if used properly, certainly many of the topics appear well-designed for minority students. But when you do a sort of tinkering with the admission systems, you frequently have unintended consequences. As affirmative action has been challenged, you've had a variety of plans, and frequently you don't get the desired outcome, at least not immediately.
And another thing your article points out is that admissions policies are one thing, but it's not the only way to think about diversity. Indeed, recruitment may be more important.
Right. Colleges focus a lot, certainly in the Supreme Court decision, focused on what happens around the table when the deans are deciding, should we let in student A? But minority groups, historically, there's a lot of issues about getting them to apply in the first place, explaining the process. It's very different if you come from a family where your parents went to college, where it's expected that you'll go to to college. People know the system, know how to work it. And colleges that have focused a lot of attention on encouraging people to apply and literally helping them through the process are finding that there are many minority students who are entirely eligible and are going to succeed, but they just haven't been identified. So there's a lot that colleges can do that has nothing to do with actual admissions decisions.
I would say student A doesn't have a problem. It's student C plus who has a problem.
Yes.
Anyway, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255 or email us, TOTN@npr.org. And Jason is with us from Massillon, Ohio.
Hi, Neil. First-time caller. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thanks for calling.
I more or less have a comment. I am a student at the University of Akron. I recently got out of the Marine Corps and am now pursuing a bachelor's in music education. My comment is the University of Akron has a lot of donors, a lot of affluent donors from the Ohio area who are from they're white, and I just don't see the diversity. Not so much in my music classes, but more in my general education classes. I can probably count maybe one African American. You know, I see a lot of Asians pointing more to the guests you have there. You know, the standardized tests are more for the ethnic groups do different ethnic groups do better at
different things
than
others. Yeah,
and it's really unsettling. Coming from the Marine Corps,
I was going to say it must be quite a change.
It is very, very unsettling.
Yeah, Scott Jasek, is Jason's experience unusual?
No, it's not. I think, the military is in fact known as one of the most successful parts of American society in terms of diversity. But it's important to remember that at most colleges and universities, affirmative action policies have little to do with how diverse a campus is. It's a very small minority of American colleges that have competitive admissions. And so whether you're going to see a lot of minority students at most colleges may have more to do with recruitment, the availability of student aid, high school graduation rates than about affirmative action.
Jason, are as you are around there on campus, do you see anything that or talk to people and do they say anything about what the school is doing about affirmative action or diversity?
I don't see a lot of protesting, a lot of student action groups. I do see a lot of noses in the air, so to speak. The communities around the University of Akron are, affluent white communities, and there's just not the base to bring in. I guess it's just. I don't know how else to say it. It's just very unsettling.
I think nose is in the air. We got the point, Jason. We appreciate the phone call.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
And good luck at school. We're going to be Scott Jasek. Applications are changed, perceptions are certainly on recruiting. These play a large part in this all.
Yes, they do. One of the places I recently read about is Texas A&M University, which does not have affirmative action. But this year, they also made the move of ending preferences for legacy admissions. That means people whose parents or grandparents went to the college. Legacy admissions, to many minority students, are a sign that they may not be welcome, that there's still an old boy network that keeps them out. And a change in policy there seems to have generated a lot of goodwill among minority students about an institution that wasn't always being flocked with minority applicants.
Far from it, indeed, yeah. We'll talk more about this when we get back from a break. We're talking about diversity in higher education a year after the Supreme Court rulings, and we're taking your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about diversity at colleges and universities. It's 1 year to the day since the Supreme Court rulings on the University of Michigan cases. What do you think is the best way to ensure diversity on today's campuses? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. And Peter's with us from Oakland.
Hi.
Hi, Peter.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned that there's no discussion or evaluation of whether or not affirmative action really serves the greater purpose of racial integration and harmony. For instance, I went to a school for an undergrad, Caltech, which, while it made every effort to attract women, it didn't do much affirmative action for women. But the women were all treated as equals. However, I understand that at other schools that did, great affirmative action to get women in a similar situation, that people would then regard the women as, substandard because they're often, they didn't get there on their own accord, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I would like to see someone address, are there studies, is there anything, are there any addresses, is affirmative action really helping racial integration, or is it hurting it by giving people, by reinforcing stereotypes?
Scott?
It all depends who you ask. There are researchers who will say that, in fact, affirmative action does what you say, that it stigmatizes the beneficiaries of affirmative action. But there are many other researchers who say that without a critical mass of minority groups or of women, say, at an engineering institution like Caltech, it makes it much more difficult for those who are there to succeed. There's also conflicting research on the impact of a diverse student body on everyone, on the majority students. Many people, and this is certainly a key part of the Supreme Court ruling, believe that all students benefit when they are educated with students who aren't like themselves. But on the question of research, you can find researchers on any side of this issue.
So it's not clear.
It really depends what you want to believe.
And or who you want to talk to, I guess, is the point.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Peter. Let's go to John, and John's on the phone from Salt Lake City.
Hi, I'm a guidance counselor and a teacher in a big public high school in Salt Lake, very ethnically mixed. And first of all, the premise that diversity should be the goal of higher education escapes me. I always thought the goal of higher education was higher education, but diversity is certainly important there. What I talk to kids about and sending them on to public universities, private universities, or work is, first of all, if you want to increase diversity, that's a no-brainer. You lower standards. I mean, that works if that's the whole goal, is to just get, more diverse student bodies. But what I try to tell the kids is don't be confused by getting in with being prepared to achieve. And if you're let in because of your status, if that status is other than high academic achievement, you better be prepared to start doing the hardest work of your life in terms of reading and writing and catching up.
Mm-hmm. Scott Jasek, that point that John was making, lowering standards, that was one that Justice Scalia made in the Supreme Court arguments on this point. He said that's a way to ensure diversity.
That is, but I think that may oversimplify the issue a little bit. First, some things to remember. At competitive colleges, they don't just admit the students who are capable of doing the work. Usually, most of the students they're rejecting are capable of doing the work. Obviously, if you had no standards, you would have a different situation. So I don't think it's quite fair to imply that any attention to diversity would result in unqualified students getting in. Also, frankly, that's where the role of the guidance counselors like yourself comes to play. A good guidance counselor is going to point students to maybe the best colleges where they could succeed, not just someplace that would let them in.
If they're not academically prepared, the unfortunate, sad part of that is the best colleges where they could succeed tend to be colleges that are not upper echelon colleges. I would rather prepare all students, regardless of where they came from, to be able to compete academically wherever they go.
I don't think anyone would disagree with you.
Yeah, so it's not adequate to say, well, if they want to go to college, just send them off to, the classic anybody can get in and nobody has to be able to read or write to get out either. I mean, if you want all students to be able to achieve high academically, the point that all counselors and teachers and parents and everybody interested ought to be telling them is getting in isn't the point.
Yeah.
Getting out of it with an advanced education is the point.
I think most college educators would agree with you, but it's important to remember we're not in a perfect world. Life for colleges would be much easier if every high school graduate was well-prepared, if every high school was outstanding, but they're not. And so the people making these admissions decisions have to work in that imperfect world.
To be fair, I think high schools would be much better off if grade schools were.
Absolutely.
John, anyway, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. 7 years ago, a federal court outlawed the use of race in the admissions policies at all public universities in the state of Texas. Joining us now to explain the diversity plan for the University of Texas at Austin is Sheldon Eklund Olson, the school's provost. He joins us by phone from his office on campus. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you.
After the federal court banned the use of race in admissions policies, the legislature came up with a plan known as the 10% plan. What's that?
Well, basically, it is a plan where if a student fulfills a certain set of criteria, if they end up in the top 10% of their high school graduating class, then they are admitted to a university in Texas.
And that, indeed, the numbers for minorities at Texas public universities stayed pretty good, but a lot of people said that's because a lot of the high schools are segregated, in effect.
Well, whether or not that's – no one has looked at that very carefully, but the fact of the matter is if you have a law that says if you do well in your high school, your chances of getting into the university are guaranteed, that sends a very powerful message to the families of these students and clarifies what needs to be done in terms of what the students need to focus on. So in our experience, it's been a very positive, in my opinion, very positive law.
Yet it's coming under attack these days.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, part of it is that for the University of Texas at Austin, the entering class has been increasingly occupied by a larger proportion of students from the 10%. It started out about, well, just a little under 50% of the entering class, and now it's up to about 65 or 70%.
Mm-hmm.
And we are concerned that, you don't want just one criteria to drive the entire admission process. So what we're looking for is some sort of continuation of the law, but allowing us to cap the proportion of students that are admitted at something like 50 to 60% of the entering class. And we feel very comfortable because these kids, they do very well in terms of their performance at the university, and we've been watching the five cohorts that have gone through.
Mm-hmm. Scott Jasek, you've looked into this. What's happening there in Texas?
Yeah, I'm hearing actually a lot of criticism of the 10% rule, although it does achieve more diversity. At good high schools, many students who maybe are in the top 15% feel they are being unfairly kept out. You also have the problem that it does depend on segregated high schools. They did analysis of this in some other states where high schools are more desegregated and it would have no impact on diversity in colleges. And finally, when you admit the top 10% sort of regardless, you may remove an incentive that school districts have to get better. When a public university like the University of Texas or the University of Michigan, someplace that parents really want their kids to go to, says, to get in, you have to achieve these things, you have to take these courses, that's a powerful message. And that can be undercut if all you have to do is be in the top 10%.
Mm-hmm. Sheldon Eklund Olson, how much of this is being driven by the parents of those kids in good high schools who say, look, we don't want to send our kid out of state to school?
How much of the of what?
Of the criticism of the 10% plan.
Oh, I think the criticism is really being driven by the fact that we can't admit everybody. And there's always going to be the same, pretty much the same level of criticism. It'll just come from different segments of the society. But the idea, at least in our experience, that students from very good high schools, whether they're private or public, are not being admitted to the university, it's just simply not true.
Mm-hmm.
We've looked at this very, very carefully.
So that
criticism that it is keeping out high quality students, it depends on what you mean by high quality, and usually it means that the students that are being let in are judged in higher quality on some standard other than the one I want it judged on.
Mm-hmm. As a result of the Supreme Court decision for a year ago today, is the University of Texas considering resuming using race as a factor?
We will use it. It's under review. And what if we do use it, consistent with the Supreme Court decision, it'll be used in what is referred to as a holistic review of the student's portfolio. And so it won't be given, you know, the Supreme Court has outlawed the idea that many universities implemented that you would be given, you know, a certain set number of points for being in a particular ethnic group. What we'll do is take into account to the extent that it makes some meaningful difference in the overall evaluation of the individual's record.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
Sure.
Sheldon Eklund Olson is provost at the University of Texas at Austin. He joined us by phone from his office on campus. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is April, who's with us from Indianapolis.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. This
sure.
is the first time I've called into the show.
Oh, great.
I did have a comment in regards to the issue in that, as a student who's attended a university, an African-American student, that the issues of diversity that a lot of individuals discuss need to be taken past the admissions process, that once students are accepted to the university, there are still things that the school can do to make the environment more conducive for diverse students. So that even though they're going to class and they have the requirements of other students to pass their tests, to complete their reports, there still is this perception that they do not belong.
So
and that is expressed in almost every social situation.
Like?
For example, if you're in a science class, group work is mandatory. You have to perform labs as a group. It was not uncommon as an African-American student for other students to turn away from me who did not want to participate with me because perhaps the perception was that I wasn't as good of a student as they were.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they felt that I would somehow bring their scores down or at least not benefit to the group.
And so the, Scott Jasek, obviously, there have to be, April's point is seems almost irrefutable.
Absolutely. I mean that's bigotry, and she shouldn't be judged on the basis of stereotype. I think what that points to is that when people talk about diversity in higher education, they want to talk not just about admissions, but about graduation. So, you know, one of the goals here is people want a more diverse workforce. They want more minority lawyers and doctors and politicians and so forth. And to do that, people need to be comfortable and to succeed in college, not just to get in.
Are you still in school, April?
No, I've graduated 7 years ago, and I am beginning law school in this fall.
And I wonder, do you anticipate some of the same problems? Law students also have to work together.
Yes. I don't anticipate it, but based upon my undergraduate experience, if it happens, I will do the best that I can and try and be prepared for it.
Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
And let's move on from there. Joining us now to give us some perspective on how diversity affects students of color is Rich Reddick, a doctoral student at Harvard Graduate School of Education. He's also a researcher with the National Campus Diversity Project and joins us now from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Welcome.
Thank you, Neil.
You were actually accepted as an undergraduate student at the University of Texas at Austin last year, the last year that affirmative action was in place.
Yeah, I actually came to the University of Texas in 1990, and I was a scholarship student, and I was among one of the last classes to receive the scholarships before the ruling back of affirmative action through the Hopwood case. And in fact, I spent my last summer in Austin calling students and reassuring them that even though Hopwood had come down, the university was still a place they would want to pursue their studies.
Well, what happened on campus when the decision was made to outlaw the use of race there? What was the reaction like?
Well, I think, Neil, a couple of things happened. One thing that happened, I suppose, is just the attacks. And the Hopwood case actually had gone through a number of iterations. It had gone through the district court and circuit court and so forth. So I think students became aware of the severity of this issue late in the game, so to speak. And I'm happy that the folks at Michigan really got in the ball quickly and had became active. And we had the march in Washington, D.C. last year. As far as reactions, I would say it's really split. I mean, among students of color, clearly there was a disappointment and a shock sort of thing. But among conservative students or students who believe in this idea of a merit by numbers, I think they sensed a victory.
We're talking about diversity on campuses a year after the Supreme Court decisions. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Rich Reddick, you currently research best practices to attract diversity with the National Campus Diversity Process Project. Rather, you found that there's often a disconnect between students and administration as to what diversity is and how diverse their school really is.
Oh, absolutely, Neil. I think oftentimes initiatives come out of high places in the campus culture. It comes out of the president's office or the provost's office. And there are initiatives and there are programs in place. But oftentimes when you talk to the students, first, oftentimes they're not even aware of what's happening as far as the institution, what the institution is actually doing. So a lot of it is the marketing of the program. The second part of it is having collaborative sort of nature in producing these sorts of programs. Because if people in a – if you know, administrators who are 20 years removed from the college experience are formulating how a program should look, oftentimes the students who are currently enrolled – have a different opinion or a different take on it. So we see a lot of that happening. It's often the desire at the end of the interview is to say, we will just get you all together to talk about what ideas you both sides have, so to speak, because that's where you actually see the richness and the students can say, well, that idea sounds really good, but in reality, students are too busy to be involved in this particular project or whatever they suppose.
I wonder if you detect any irony in the criticisms of the 10% system at the University of Texas at Austin that have been coming out in recent days.
I think it's interesting to see where they come from. Dean Eklund Olson, who's actually my dean when I was at the University of Texas, made a great point about where the criticism is coming from. And I read Scott's article, and it was interesting to kind of think about the fact that, you know, among the most privileged folks in society, now there's a sort of a perception that what's guaranteed to them, a college admission to the college of their choice, is being challenged in some way, and that's causing resentment. But ultimately, those students often end up in prestigious institutions no matter what. So I think it's interesting that students, or I should say the protests come from folks who will at some point end up in university, very good university, perhaps not the one they chose initially, their first choice, but one of the first choices they had. And I think Scott's point about the competitive admissions is excellent because when you think about it, there's like 3,000 universities in this country, and only a small percentage are competitive. So we're talking about a very small number of folks who are actually, I think, subjected to this idea of not being able to get into the college they choose.
Can you stay with us?
Sure.
We're going to take a short break and then ask a couple of more questions on this anniversary of the Supreme Court decisions on affirmative action. We're also going to be talking after the break with Francis Huien, who's the author of a new book called Idiot Proof, Deluded Celebrities, Irrational Power Brokers, Media Morons, and the Erosion of Common Sense. Might sound like a celebrity gossip book. It isn't. It's a defense of the Enlightenment. We'll be talking about that as well when we come back from the break and taking more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-98-TALK, email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow on the program, the word documentary implies a level of truth, but whose truth? The control room claims for objectivity. Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 doesn't. Truth, Fiction, and the Rise of Political Documentaries tomorrow at this time on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're wrapping up our conversation on diversity in higher education. This is a year to the day after the Supreme Court decisions in the University of Michigan cases. Our guests are Rich Reddick, who's a doctoral student at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and a researcher with the National Campus Diversity Project, and Scott Jasik, who's editor of Higher Ed Today. And let's get another caller on the line, and this is Stephanie, who's been patient with us on the phone in Caldwell, Idaho.
Hi.
Hi, Stephanie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I have a couple comments and a couple questions. Someone touched on this before, but I think it's something that's very important. The location of a university has a lot to do with whether or not that university is actually diverse, because if you're located in the middle of an area that has a high concentration of one ethnic group or the other, you tend to have the bulk of your students coming from that ethnic group.
Mm-hmm.
Also, someone mentioned about lowering standards as a good way to increase diversity. I don't think that's very wise.
I think that was a rhetorical point, Stephanie, but
yeah,
go ahead with your question.
Okay. The one thing that bothers me the most is that I'm a young lady of mixed heritage, And it really bothers me to know that my actual abilities may not be what has got me into a university. It may be just, you know, what race is put down on a piece of paper. And there's a lot of talk that has been going on about diversity in mainly white universities, but what about diversity in other minority group universities? For example, my husband, who is blonde and has green eyes, went to a mainly African-American school for a while, and it was hard for him to fit in, and there were not, and he was like the token white boy. Everybody knew him because he was the only person who was an African-American on campus. And how does that affect admission? How does that affect
Scott, diversity? If I could speak to that, there are in this country a lot of historically black colleges, and it's very important to know that these were institutions that were created in the era of legal segregation. The black colleges weren't created to exclude whites. They were created because white society didn't want to educate black people. All of the black colleges, literally every one of them, would welcome white applicants. The reality is they don't get very many. But speaking to your other points about you're of mixed race and other kinds of diversity, the mixed background issue is important because a lot of affirmative action policies were designed historically with the idea that people did fit neatly into one category or another, and increasingly today they don't. Also, diversity needs to be looked at much more broadly. You mentioned the issue of location. There are a lot of, at major public universities, there's a lot of interest in getting students from all parts of the state or from rural parts of the state and urban and suburban. So diversity...
And minority covers a lot more than race,
And
too.
Minority covers a lot more than race. So when you talk about diversity, the affirmative action decision in Michigan focused on race. But when educators talk about diversity and when students think about, did I have an education in a diverse environment, it's much more than race.
Stephanie, thank you. Go ahead, Rich. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of chime in on the historically black college discussion. I'm actually working on a manuscript right now on historically black colleges. And in fact, there are at least five or six historically black colleges that are no longer predominantly black. Bluefield State in West Virginia and Langston in Oklahoma come to mind that are schools that actually have a majority of whites or at least 40% white populations now.
Well, let me ask you both a question. What do you think would happen if the Supreme Court had ruled, look, no affirmative action, no 10% rule, no legacies, no rules, no nothing. You guys just handle it by yourselves and let's get government off your back in this question. What do you think would happen in that if that was the case? Rich?
I think it really depends on the sort of the campus philosophy and leadership from top. And one of the things we've discovered in our research is that institutional direction is extremely important. And certain campuses wouldn't probably fare quite well when you consider that because, unfortunately, we tend to reduce discussions on merit to test scores and those sorts of attributes. And as a caller made a point earlier, there's so much more to a student than a test score or one aspect of their lives. And you think about something like your racial background, your ethnicity, and if you've worked through that and you've lived that way for, 18 years, that's got an incredible influence on your life as compared to taking a standardized test, which may have caught you on a great day or on a bad day. And I'm not dismissing the value of those tests, but I am saying that we tend to focus on that as being the predictor of merit. And when you think about the essays that they have at Michigan, I think it's a wonderful way of thinking about a student who can thoughtfully respond to those questions. When they finish in 4 years, will probably be able to contribute to society in a way superior to somebody who couldn't answer those questions, but maybe scored perfect 800s in the SAT.
Scott?
Maybe I'm a little more cynical, but I think what you'll see happen with those essays is a lot of students are going to develop reasons why they had underprivileged backgrounds. And many of the students may well be wealthy and white and have gone to good high schools. All of this takes place in a context in which applicants to competitive colleges are trying to game the system. They're trying to do anything for an edge. So colleges need to know that whatever rules they put in place, bright students are going to spend a lot of energy trying to get a leg up.
Exactly.
Well, thanks to you both. An interesting conversation. Scott Jasik is the editor of Higher Ed Today, a publication that makes its debut later this year. He joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Rich Reddick, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Rich Reddick, a doctoral student at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, a researcher with the National Campus Diversity Project.